Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, good evening, and God bless. Welcome to Tribe Family Channel Voices of Wisdom with Beverly Black Johnson. I am the creator of Tribe Family Channel, and it is my esteemed privilege, pleasure, and honor to welcome Presidential Diarist Janice F. Kearney, author of Conversations, author of Conversations, William Jefferson Clinton, From Hope to Harlem, an oral biography centered around the Clinton presidency and political legacy, and former publisher of the Arkansas State Press newspaper. We are here today to talk about her book, Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road. Good afternoon, Janice. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me on your show, and I'm happy to be here.
It's my honor and privilege to welcome you on behalf of Tribe Family Channel, Gumbo for the Soul International, and Bruce George Media. Thank you so much for making yourself available. I know that we had some time changes and that you are a author, speaker, and you travel. So I want to also thank you for, accommodating us on this particular, day. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure, really. It was no problem at all.
Great. Now, you know what? I have to tell the audience how I came about finding Janice F. Kearney. Before we even get off into anything, it is purely by chance that you are included in an email that was being, there was dialogue going on between another client of myself and Bruce George's. And when I saw the title of your book in your signature, I flipped. I was like, what? Her father lived to be 107 years old and, 100 years of memories and this patriarch, this amazing picture. You heard from me like immediately after that email went out. Am I right?
You are correct, and I was very humbled by that. I really was.
Yes. Well, this is one of the things that is dear to our hearts is memoirs and history, our history. This book, I recommend that all of our readers, log on to your website, writingourworldpress.com, and order Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road. Now, let me just tell people a little bit about the book. I'm going to read from the back of it before we get off into our conversation so that our readers can be fully abreast of this wonderful and amazing book. In her fourth memoir, Sundays with TJ, author Janice F. Kearney attempts to answer the one question most asked of 107-year-old Thomas James T.J. Kearney. What was the magical recipe to his longevity, his continued health, and his passion for life? The author and daughter answers the question the only way she knows how, by telling T.J. Kearney's life story. The writer deftly takes readers on an unforgettable journey as she chronicles the life and times of the centurion whose life began just 40 years after slavery in the atypically southern town of Lake Village, Arkansas. TJ's early childhood, she writes, was shaped by his early losses, and his fascination with steamboats, trains, and the Mississippi River. Janice F. Kearney offers her readers glimpses of the many facets of an adoring son, a wanderer, a rustabout, a cotton sharecropper, and a loving husband and father of 19 children. After all is said and done, Kearney asserts the wise and witty centurion lived an amazing life and left with few regrets. The regrets, he said at 107, were the people he didn't meet, the places he never visited, if only he had one more time. Wow. Where do we start? Let's start with Janice Kearney as a person with 18 siblings. What is your earliest remembrance of yourself, and which number in the lineup are you?
That is a great question because, you know, when you come from a family the size of mine, it's very hard to remember anything where it's just you. It's always you in the middle of a whole bunch of other people. My earliest memories, they always include some of my siblings that were closest to my age, and specifically a sister who was a year and a half younger, and we were very, very close. And I remember at 6 years old, my dad bought dresses for us to go to school. I was starting to school, and actually he bought one for both of us. And I will never forget those dresses. They were checked, blue checked gingham. Mine was blue checked. My sister's was red checked. But I'll always remember that day when he brought those two dresses home. But all of my memories are linked with someone in my family. We were a very close family. We grew up loving each other, loving having so many people to share things with. We learned all the things that we learned together and worked together, went to school together. We did everything together.
Wow. Fascinating. I come from a small family, and I always wanted to feel as though I belong to this huge tribe and this, you know, large family and stuff. So, you know, here I am with Tribe Family Channel, right?
Right.
So let's talk about family. I want to go over to where you talk about the painful history of our beginnings as we hear about your beginnings and your father's beginnings. This historical account also covers the beginnings of us Black people as a people, as African slaves and Native Americans. And so from your book, Chapter 3, The Great Black Exodus from the Delta to the Prairie, it reads, "It is from a history of painful, senseless displacement that both the African slaves and the Native Americans have had to rebuild their sense of place. For many, the rebuilding proved far too difficult. For others, though the rebuilding was successful, their souls and spirits would forever be haunted by their past, a loss of that all-important sense of security in the present. Cynthia and Thomas Clayton Kearney's lives and that of their heirs would forever be tied to the sad and tragic reality." So tell us about your grandparents before you tell us about your dad, that may be reflections of what your dad has told you.
My grandparents, my grandmother, Cynthia, was born in Lake Village, Arkansas, which is right across the line from Louisiana. And her family was all there in Lake Village. My grandfather, T.C., as they called him, Thomas Clayton, was born in Carroll Parish, in East Carroll Parish. in Louisiana, but he made his way from Louisiana into Lake Village, he and his family. We know very little about my grandfather's parents. My dad couldn't tell us much at all, but we know that he came from Louisiana. They married in, I think it was 1901, and at some point, and there's no documentation, but they were a part of the Exodus, the Black Exodus, as they called it, traveling to Oklahoma as part of a kind of the gold rush type thing. People put out these flyers saying there's jobs, there's land, you know, come to Oklahoma. I think they did it with certain states. Kansas City was one of them. And so they ended up going there, and they stayed there for a while, but they didn't stay. They came back. And many, many African Americans, former slaves or children of slaves, did that. But and some of them found some, you know, a place that they could make home, make it their home, and others couldn't, so they returned. And my parents were part of that exodus, but they didn't remain in Oklahoma. But they had, there was a lot of interaction. There was a lot of interaction between blacks and Indians. And my mother, my grandmother, is believed to have had two of her children during the time that she was there. As a matter of fact, but the question is whether they are partial Indian or not.
Wow. And here's a portion in chapter 8. TJ's memories of his mother are bittersweet. He recalls a woman doggedly attached to her husband and children, and at the same time distant and rarely interactive with family beyond what was necessary. In so many ways, he recalls she was different from other mothers in the community. Cynthia was what people called a handsome woman back then. Many mistook her for a full-blooded Indian. Her reddish-brown complexion and somber demeanor would have given them that impression. She is also remembered for her piercing eyes and her sparse conversation. She dressed to suit her personality, conservative, ignoring contemporary fashion rules. She sewed most of her clothing herself. Her full head of jet black hair was most often bound together in a loose bun at the nape of her neck. Sounds like she was definitely full-blooded Indian with this jet black hair.
Right.
And, you know, when you look at your father's features, I mean, he has some really strong features. You know, he looks like a Indian patriarch, if you will. You know, he looks like he could be in headdress and, you know, be part of. I'm serious. I mean, he's just, his picture is striking. It's very striking.
Right.
Regal.
Right. But we always try to get him to tell us, like, what were you a part of? Because we could always tell he was. He had a lot of Native American blood, but he couldn't tell us exactly. He just knew his mother had some in her, and he thought that his dad did as well. But he wasn't able to tell us a lot about that. But there was, I think there was that relationship between Native Americans and African Americans that was very complicated to a great extent. There were relationships and children that were born to Native Americans and African Americans. But also there was that period when Native Americans actually enslaved African Americans as well. So there was a kind of a complicated relationship. Here are two displaced peoples that, you know, are trying to learn how to live with each other and live with themselves and figure out how they fit into this country as a whole.
Exactly. And let's see. It says, Cynthia Davis Kearney today would surely be described as a reclusive, but it also talks about TJ's fascination with his mother because, you know, she knew some things. It talks about his fascination with her other worldly convictions regarding mysticism and spirits and root medicine. And it says, even as a child, TJ shared her wonder about the world, particularly things that had little to do with man, but more to do with nature. And tell us about, you know, his reflections with his mother's closeness with nature and her, you know, there had to be that oneness with the Creator.
Yeah, definitely. And the interesting thing about his mother is that she was never a religious person. She never, as far as my dad could remember, she never attended church. She never joined a church, really.
But that doesn't mean that spiritual side is there, because when you see
she was definitely spiritual. But she didn't belong to an organized religion. That's what I meant. And but at the same time, she had some wisdoms about nature and about how to take care of her family and herself. She believed in the power of nature. And my dad was a lot like that. I'm not sure he had planned to turn out like that, but as he grew older, his wisdom from just being kind of in tune with nature became really, really powerful as he got older. And my dad was very, very religious and very involved in church and all of that, but he's still on the other side of that. He knew the power of just nature and taking care of ourselves without medicine and chemical, you know, pills and all that kind of thing.
Sounds like, reminds me of my grandmother. You know, my people are from Louisiana, and, you know, so it says here, and this just falls right in line with where we are. TJ had two conflicting allegiances. He loved his father unconditionally and wanted more than anything to be just like him. He would, in fact, mimic many of his father's ways as an adult, yet he held on to many of Cynthia's beliefs, including the ones about spirits or haunts who return to earth sporadically. And there is a spiritual level to this, outside of the church house, outside of religious, you know, white collars and, you know, certain doctrines and theologies. Outside of all of that is a creator who created nature and all of man that populated this land. And to be in touch with that is to delve into another sense of self and existence, in which I would believe that, you know, your grandmother was able to access. And so it says, because there is little knowledge of Cynthia's early life, her beliefs may very well represent a combination of the Louisiana Creole and Native American mysticism she would have been familiar with as a child. Both would have been considered taboo and unacceptable in Southeast Arkansas. Because of that power and the belief in that power, that's what made it so taboo among our people, because our people know some stuff, you know?
That's right. Yeah. And Dad said she was not, you know, she did not go out and talk about things that she believed and, you know, because people didn't accept it. People didn't accept it. So that's why she was a recluse. She did everything that she did inside her own home or with her own family.
And what is so beautiful is to give the world 19 children, you know, to follow God's plan for your life, because we're here to follow God's plan and to be in touch with nature and God. He said to be fruitful and multiply.
Yes.
Didn't say run out
and
there run behind man and every belief and ideology that came out of man's mouth, because when you are quiet and in your own space and zone and you're connected with nature, it is a beautiful place. It's an absolute beautiful place to be. And people will consider you strange. You know, if you, I read my Bible every day, and it talks about, my pastor, Pastor T.D. Jakes, he talks about looking like a fool for God, okay?
Mm-hmm.
People will, when you're, you know, really in touch with, you know, that spiritual side of life, you will absolutely seem strange to other people, and it will absolutely push you away, because the average person cannot connect you on that level. And I can imagine the average person not being able, especially, you know, in those times and back then, and, you know, imagine how they treated the women in the Bible days. And so now here we are with, Native American or Native Indian and Black in the South, and, you know, that knows some stuff, you know, it's no joke, it's powerful. And imagine the ostracization that comes along with that, because people do fear that power. People would rather not know.
Sure, that's exactly right. If you can't explain it, then, you know, you'd rather say it's not real, or it's not, you know, authentic, or,
Right,
what she went through.
Right. Well, bless your parents, your grandparents, I'm sorry, God bless them. And then let's talk about the Kearney family in Lincoln County. We're going to fast forward to, tell us, before we get to the part where where TJ is 5 years old, tell us where he was born, and tell us about that. Where was your father born?
My father was born in it's in Chico County, which is Lake Village is in Chico County, but he was born outside Chico County in a place called Macon Lake, off Macon Lake Road. And it was just basically a plantation area, a big farm was there, and his dad worked on the farm, and so they had a little home there. And for a time, his dad actually owned cotton and did very, very well. But in time, what happened was there was a year when everybody suffered from a season when I'm trying to think of what they were, but it was a bug that actually killed all the plants, killed the cotton. So my dad
had a
my granddad
of,
lost.
There
were
had
worms.
A swarm
at one
of like
time,
locusts
it,
or worms or something.
Locusts. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And they destroyed the plants, and nobody had a crop that year. And of course, my dad wasn't, you know, wealthy or anything. So when he lost his crop, he lost everything. My granddad,
right? Because
and,
that is the income when sharecropping.
Mm-hmm.
Now
and
sharecropping. You said your grandfather had land, or was he
My grandfather at one point during, you know, his young marriage, he had land. He had obviously purchased some land, but he lost that land. And from that point on, he was never able to, you know, do that again. From that point on, he became a itinerant farmer and a sharecropper. And that's what my dad knew all of his childhood.
Right. That was a turn of events, because back then, you know, to be a black man and to have that level of independence, mm-hmm. I can imagine the tricks and scams and the sharecropping, new rules and Jim Crow, that was before Jim Crow, but it was certainly sharecropping was 1 foot outside of slavery, just enough. Mm-hmm. Your foot wasn't in chains. You could walk mm-hmm. freely without the chains. So when you mm-hmm. say he lost the land, that's another mm-hmm. story in itself. That's another story in itself. And so we fast forward to TJ, not yet 5 years old, when his parents moved from Chico County to Lincoln County, right outside the small town of Grady, Arkansas. Again, they lived mm-hmm. near a river levee like they did in Chico County. The river continued to play an important role in TJ's childhood. And mm-hmm. I'm reading from chapter 9,
mm-hmm.
Page 99 in your book. It says, here the Mississippi, Round River and Long River, all roughly 5 miles on the outskirts of Grady, provided a great deal of enjoyment, including fishing for the Kearney children. T.C. Kearney rented farmland, cleared the wooded area, made available to them, and built a small home for his family, which began their farm life in Lincoln County. They lived in the area for nearly a decade, 1911 through 1918. While sharecropping was a harsh life for T.C. and his family, it was the only one for a slave's son seeking survival for his large family.
Mm-hmm.
Between T.J.'s birth in 1906 and his fifth birthday in 1910, the Kearney family moved 5 times. From Lake Village to Macon Lake, from Macon Lake to Beth River, from Beth River to Laconia, from Laconia mm-hmm. to Tiller near Bayou Bartholomew, and now from mm-hmm. Tiller to Grady, Long Lake in Lincoln County. Now, are these moves sharecropping related, where the sharecroppers themselves would the sharecropper landowners, you know, that whole little
union. Yes, a lot of it had to do with that. Farmers Union.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But yes, my granddad would move, and my dad would tell us that sometimes in the middle of the night he would move because he had either been cheated or someone had treated him wrong. And mm-hmm. he just didn't want to put up with it. So he'd leave and find another place to live and start mm-hmm. all over again. And, you know, he probably could have stayed in one place and put up with a whole lot that he didn't want to put up with, as many mm-hmm. people did. But he had that dignity that he wanted to. I mean, he had to work for someone else, but he didn't want to have to give up his humanity. You know. To work for someone else. So he ended up moving around a lot.
Right. And it was that constant search for a fair mm-hmm. landowner, because I remember we had another author on our radio show, and her parents were sharecroppers, and they, you know, did some of the same moving and looking for, mm-hmm. you know, either Christian sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. Word would get out from family to family, hey, come over here and work for, you know, so-and-so. He's fair. And mm-hmm. because at the end of the year, when it was time to settle the bill, and for our listeners who don't know, we're tuned in to Tribe Family Channel having a conversation with Janice F. Kearney, diarist of the former President William Clinton. We're discussing Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road. And what some people don't know about sharecropping is that at the end of the year, well, first of all, you're living, the sharecropper is living mm-hmm. on land that is in this co-op, so to speak,
right,
where you live on the land, the blacks that are, you know, 1 foot out of slavery, You can live here mm-hmm. free, but you work the land, and the sharecropping part is that the blacks would work the land for the cotton and the goods to be sold and then would be paid out of what was mm-hmm. reaped at the harvest time. But what would happen mm-hmm. is at harvest time, the white man would say, oh, you didn't clear how much your
right.
rent was for the year that you were on the land working it, and so you owe us. And they would keep this cycle going where the people would never get out of being in debt to the landholder. So hence sharecropping mm-hmm. was just another cycle of slavery. And it sounds like your grandfather was one of those that would aspire higher for his family, knowing that he could make a difference and be determined to not live and have his mm-hmm. family stay in that cycle, whereas you mm-hmm. would have people, you have people today that are free and don't want to be. And so I can Come imagine on. Back then you have sharecroppers that didn't mind staying in that cycle because mm-hmm. of not knowing anything. Anything else is additional work. If you're already mm-hmm. pressed against life and the vicissitudes of trying to live against, you know, the white man, and right. then now you're fighting even more. It's another movement in itself. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's mm-hmm. not going to fight in the movement. Some are going to sit back no. And let the fight go on without them, but reap the benefits. Right. So we right. definitely pay homage to your grandfather for being one that would fight to overcome that. And mm-hmm. so now we're on mm-hmm. page 101. It says, ironically, slave labor was common in the county named. Well, let me not skip too far ahead. Let's see. On page 100, let's see. It says, one difference, however, was that by the time Europeans settled into the area that would eventually become Lincoln County, very few Native Americans remained. Wow. The relocation mm-hmm. of the entire Indian population and culture occurred around that time. The Quapaw, am I saying that correct, Indians,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
lived in this area before it was discovered and inhabited by whites. And the word discovered is in quotation marks, but because we know
right.
that this land was not discovered.
Right, so you can't rediscover something.
How are you going to discover something where people are residing on?
Right,
you just
exactly.
happened upon here, should have shot every last one of them when it came to shore. the settlement of Lincoln County by whites and their black slaves began in earnest in the early 19th century. One area believed to have been the site of a Quapaw village existed near the Arkansas River, located between Gauld and Grady. The area was settled in 1827 by the McLean, Lee, and Douglas's families and was later renamed Douglas Landing. And then as we progress further into the book, talks about how ironic slave labor was, you know, ironically slave mm-hmm. labor was common in that county before mm-hmm. It was named for the president who abolished slavery in the South. Dr. John A. Mm-hmm. Jordan of Tennessee bought a great deal of land from a Frenchman, and it just goes on and on into that. Now, tell us, mm-hmm. What are some of your father TJ's memories about if he shared
about Lincoln County,
about Lincoln County, and particularly about the sharecropping?
Oh, he remembers just it was hard work for sure, and they all, he and his siblings, he was one of nine, but I think three of his siblings were older, so they were not there. He grew up with six siblings, and they all had mm-hmm. to work beside their dad, go to the fields and mm-hmm. and work, and they weren't able to go to school on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
He remembered that he loved school. He always loved learning, but the only time they ever got to go into the school was when it rained or when, you know, it was the weather was so bad that they couldn't walk. But he had fond memories of school and the teachers. He remembered all of his teachers. And so he was a person who could have done extremely well if he had had the opportunity to attend school on a regular basis. And he always missed that. As a matter of fact, he leaves later in the book and goes off on his own at a very young age. But he said even then, while he was traveling around the country, he would very often stop in at a school and, you know, just sit in the classrooms. People let him do that back then, I guess. So he loved learning and never stopped even as he got older. But that was one of the things that he did as a young person. And unfortunately, because of their role as sharecroppers, he wasn't able to attend school regularly.
Wow. Now, it says on page 107, the Kearney family's move to Lincoln County in 1910 marked a distinct change for the family. Not only were both T.C. and Cynthia leaving the area they knew best, but their economic condition would continuously slide downward. And then it goes on to accept that, or to say at the bottom of the page, that they accepted in due time that this new frontier offered nothing better. Their fate was a hand-to-mouth existence. Now, to say that their fate was a hand-to-mouth existence, and then to look at the accomplishments of their granddaughter, you, there is this huge sense of having achieved and broken through the barriers, and their fight is, you know, was not in vain. You know, get that sense of, you know, the fight was not in vain, and the legacy that came out of the struggle is evident in your life.
Right. And, you know, and that's something my dad always shared, how much he admired his father. He was a good husband. He took care of his family. You know, no, they were very poor. They did live hand to mouth. But as far as their values and his sense of family and responsibility, all of that, all those values that we need to succeed in life, they were there. And that's why, you know, and this is off the subject, but that's why when I hear
the subject is whatever we talk about.
When I hear some of our leaders saying, because you're poor, you know, we don't expect poor people to do this or be this. It doesn't matter whether you're poor or rich. If you have those values, you should be able to make a difference. You may not ever, you know, economically rise to where you'd like to rise, but you can make a difference in somebody's life, just like they made a difference in their son's life, and that made him who he was and who we looked up to. So it has nothing to do with what you have. It's the value system, and thank God that my grandparents had that value system.
And let me read something about you. Thank you for offering that, and then we're going to get into a little bit more about your father. But in the epilogue of your book, this is just so beautiful, so profound, and just so thought-provoking. It says, "The things I carried with me. I am Janice Faye Kearney, and I will always remember the perfect dawns of June, July, and August, broken by the muted crunch of gravel and rocks as we braved the chill of those summer mornings, our silent trek into Daddy's cotton field, into the damp, cold dew blanketing every living or dead thing, soaking our bodies, our clothing, chilling us to the bone for just a short time before the scorching sun burned us dry. I remember the strange and perfect choreography of my family's old, age-old dance. TJ and his children holding the chopping hole straight and tight as we stretch ourselves toward the delicate cotton plant, our universal focus. Ridding Daddy's 40 acres of any hint of wayward grass, when what seemed like forever came to an end, so began our barefoot walk home on the hot, sharp, but somehow soothing gravel and rock, tired, sated, hoarding our secret dreams, happy for the freedom to dream. My God. Now, I would imagine, tell me about that, because we talked about, you know, your dad and his father sharecropping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is you and
mm-hmm.
your dad sharecropping.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that, and then we're going to go into some of the interview questions about
mm-hmm.
describing TJ.
Okay. Sharecropping was a harsh life. It really was. When people ask me what it was like, I said, I can't compare it to anything. All I know is that our summers were filled with getting up early in the morning, eating our breakfast, and then going to the cotton field. And we were there all day, except we stopped to eat lunch, and then we would continue. And that was every day except Saturdays and Sundays. Our falls, for those of us my age or younger, we would come home from school, and the first thing we would do is change clothes and go to the cotton field to help my dad pick cotton. My older siblings also spent quite a bit of time out of school to pick cotton to help my dad with his cotton crop. And then when the cotton season was over, they went back to school. But the thing that was really amazing about my parents is that they wanted to make sure we did well in school, and they made sure that we learned whatever it was that we were missing
mm-hmm.
out of school, we caught up. So when we got back to school, especially the older ones who spent so much time out of school, they were expected to catch up and be the best in their classes, and they did. So
mm-hmm.
they understood not only the importance of hard work, but they understood the importance of education. So I always tell people this, that when I'm asked, what are the most important things? What were the most important things? There was education, there was hard work, and there was faith. There was God,
mm-hmm.
there was our church. Those were
mm-hmm.
the three things that centered our lives. And all of them were just as important as far as my parents were concerned. You would not do well at school. You would never miss church. You would be a part of church, and you would work hard. You would get up every day knowing that you were going to work. You were going to be doing something during that day. So,
wow.
Sharecropping was about work, but it wasn't just sharecropping. I mean, it wasn't just work. We also, my parents instilled so many other values in us. And, you know, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for all of it. You know, even the harsh work, because it taught
mm-hmm.
me that you work hard for anything that you want. Nothing
right.
comes easy.
Right,
and then,
right.
of course, the other values that they instilled in us. I'm just very grateful for that time.
Right, right. All right. Well, we're going to get into some of the things that are in the back of the book that I found very interesting, different questions that are posed. And it talks about TJ's parents, both born less than a decade after slavery, had harsh lives. So did TJ and his siblings. Was it that harsh existence that propelled an 11-year-old TJ to choose the life of a wanderer, a vagabond, or was it something else, or was it something more? And we know through the book that he had some pretty exotic travels. So tell us about your father as a traveler, a vagabond, or a wanderer?
Well, first of all, I think I'm a writer because my dad shared those stories with me when I was very young, and I fell in love with his stories, and then I decided that I should be the person that writes those stories and documents them. So I'm so grateful for my dad's stories. I really am. But they were exotic because he was so young when he left home. He was 11 years old. And he ended up doing things that grown people, adults, did. He walked at places that adults walked at. He met people from all walks of life. And he learned something from everybody he ever met. Not only that, he said that there was something about him that these older people would gravitate toward him as well. So there was a wisdom, I think, even when he was a young person, that I'm sure he got from his mom and dad, that allowed him to navigate that kind of an existence, because anything in the world could have happened to a person his age, a young person out in the world like that. But not only did nothing happen to him, but
those times.
Especially
in those times. I mean, it's not like these times where, I mean, you're black and you're traveling and you're seeing the world and you're, you know, out there, you know, braving the harsh realities of being black in America and, you know, traveling, showing up in different, you know, areas and having to deal with racism and not being allowed in certain places. So he certainly took the world for his and set out to see it.
He did. And that was his attitude. He loved learning. I mean, he loved meeting people. He loved learning things about people. He loved seeing the world. He always wanted to see the world. So he started very early doing that. And not only did was he able to navigate that, but he came back, I think, wiser for it. Able to, I think that's what made him a better father, a good father. Because he had a sense of what we could do and what we couldn't do, what our possibilities were. And he instilled that in his children. So, you know, we all know that we are really blessed to have had him with so much knowledge, with so much experience, but completely dedicated to being the best father and the best, you know, husband and the best community leader that he could be.
Wow, wow. And you talk about, you know, what started from your first memoir that kind of led to the writing of this memoir. And you had people that read Cotton Field of Dreams, and they loved the story so much. And I just want to read part of that. It says, they loved the story, but always suggested I rewrite it as my story and include my father and family as central characters. Cotton Field of Dreams became a coming-of-age story of my growing up on Varner Road as a sharecropper's daughter and the struggles of an abject poverty and the racial obstacles of the pre-civil rights South. Another huge irony, readers would inevitably gravitate to this one standout character in my story, TJ, my father. It was so amazing. They would ask more details about him and his life. So many people I met actually asked to meet him. I knew then that my first urge to write TJ's story was a good one. But in the end, all's well that ends well. I now have this wonderful opportunity to introduce TJ to some readers and reintroduce him to others. So, what was your primary purpose for writing Sundays with TJ?
I think my primary purpose, it actually came to me when I was a child. and that was to document his stories and share them with the world. I absolutely, when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, decided I wanted to be a writer, and in my mind, that meant I was going to write my dad's stories. I was going to write them and,
wow,
and share them with other people because they were so fascinating to me that, you know, this man could have lived a life like that beginning when he was so young.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I didn't have the, you know, wisdom at that age to know that there was a lot to his life,
uh-huh,
a lot to what he was giving to us, his family,
uh-huh,
and what he was to my mom as a husband,
uh-huh,
and to the community. All I knew was that he was an amazing human being, and that's what I wanted to share.
Mm-hmm. Wow, amazing, amazing. And it says, TJ believed God blessed him with healthy and intelligent children for a reason, and he would recognize that blessing by making sure his family grew up loving to learn and realizing the importance of hard work as well. He was certain the God he knew all his life, in spite of his waywardness, understood about his cotton crop and his need to take care of his family's basic needs. If all men could do that, right? To do that, he had to keep his children out of school during the first quarter. He and Ethel could not pick the crops alone. His oldest children in one day could pick half a bale of cotton over 700 pounds. And then you talk about, though he continued to keep some of the children out of school during the fall quarter, most of the Kearney children sailed easily to the top of their classes when they did attend. This was undeniably due to TJ and Ethel Kearney's agreement to ensure their children's education in spite of the obstacles. Okay, and so it was, let's see, what do you say here? Most of the raggedy-ass Kearney children without a pot to piss in, as they were often referred to by snickering classmates, very often graduated at the top of their classes or as honor students, truly a mystery to the students and teachers at field schools. And, you know, they really must be clutching their pearls and about to pass out now. So pick one memory besides that one. Pick one memory of your childhood in the Kearney household and share it with us.
Pick one memory of the Kearney. Oh, goodness. There's so many memories. And I actually do remember when I was 5 years old, when I turned 5 years old, and actually saw myself and looked at myself in the mirror and was trying to figure out things about what does it mean to be 5 years old. But I do remember that we didn't get birthday cakes, or we didn't recognize our birthdays really back then.
Mm-hmm.
There were too many of us, I'm sure. My mother would have been cooking all the time, cooking cakes.
Mm-hmm,
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But
wow,
I remember, dinner time, all of us sitting together eating dinner. I remember that I started cooking
mm-hmm.
at 9 years old because, you know, my mom needed help. So I started cooking at 9 years old. I remember, I'm not sure many people can remember the ringer top style dryer, where
mm-hmm.
You put the clothes into the roller, and the clothes
mm-hmm.
came out through the roller, and how many times I stuck my hand up in there and got my hand stuck up in the roller of the dryer.
Wow.
If you're older, you will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, you know what? I remember my cousins having that roller. I remember that washing machine. I remember my cousins would all always, oh my goodness, if it wasn't sticking their hands in the washing machine, it was in a can, you know, when we had those, you know, crazy can openers and just,
right,
oh my gosh,
right.
It was always
there was
something.
There so many things that you could get yourself in. And get you.
Yes, you know, and we're trying to improvise too, so.
Right.
Wow.
But growing up on the farm and growing up with a bunch of siblings, it's always something that you find yourself getting into.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, your mother and father, T.J. and Ethel, a love story. T.J. Kearney, the traveling man, spent most of his life searching. Finally, he discovered the sense of peace and contentment missing through most of his life. Ethel and their children were now his family, his life. Finally, he had a good reason to lay aside his traveling shoes. After decades, he was home. And what a beautiful picture of your parents. And it says, T.J. and Ethel Kearney began their 45 years of marriage in the closely knit community of Good Hope, once a plantation with a rich slave heritage. Like most of the other families, their lives revolved around the land and their families. They worked for the most part as sharecroppers and tenant farmers. But they found time to make sure that you were all, even though they had to alternate sending you to school, they made sure that, you know, all of their children were educated and graduating at the top of their class. So this is truly a story of a legacy built from, you know, very, very humble beginnings to birthing greatness and living to see, you know, the fruits of his labors and being able to tell you. It's really, you know, God will take you places so that when it comes time to giving birth to those and telling them and directing them as to what life is, I can imagine with the adventurous nature of your father, hearing about stories and travels all over the world would have been fascinating. It would have been, for me, like when I was going to the library and I would check out books from what was then Czechoslovakia, if I could pronounce it, and just other, which is, you know, now the no longer Czechoslovakia, but just reading stories from people and cultures in other lands. So I can imagine what his heart set out for was to see the world and not be boxed into what people say we have to be. And he broke barriers because who travels around the world in those times during these eras of not, this was before Jim Crow, this is sharecropping.
Yeah,
this is,
it was.
You know, what are you doing out here free, black, you know, N-I-G-G-A, really? And for him to be traveling like that and freely seeing the world and amassing these stories and, you know, then, you know, meeting his wife, a place called Good Hope, and then, you know, where they began their 45 years of marriage. He's young, he's eager, you know, they're young and eager to make something of themselves. And as a couple, you know, they worked hard and had a very good-looking young family. So... there's a season for all things now. T.J. Kearney at 107 is God's miracle at work. Tell us some of the things that in today's time that he reflected upon. Living to the year of 2013, was it?
December 2013.
So he passed in December 2013. So... what was it like to hear your father and to know his story and to know the history of your family and, you know, black people as a whole, slaves to sharecroppers to you know, No Blacks Allowed, Jim Crow, to civil rights, to a black president. Let's start from the civil right and work our way up. So let's start with, give me your father's reflection about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I had great admiration for Dr. King. He followed everything that, you know, during the civil rights struggle. He, mm-hmm. We weren't allowed to watch television, really, except for on Sundays we could watch the Animal Kingdom shows. But mm-hmm. my dad, during the civil rights struggle, he would watch all of the news, and he would always like to watch Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and listen to his mm-hmm. speeches. And he was very much a follower of Dr. King, and he was
wow.
very much into civil rights. He believed
mm-hmm.
completely that we should demand our rights and we should get mm-hmm. our rights. He was one of those people who always talked about people going to vote and how necessary and how important it was. He would take people to vote. He would make it his business to go around and pick people up to make sure they voted, because it was something that people had fought and died for, and we needed to take advantage of it. So the civil rights, the whole struggle was played out right in front of us. My dad talked about it a lot, my mom too, and we knew the importance of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he'd always compare it to the things that he had to go through and how they were treated, you know, before
mm-hmm.
Before the civil rights era. And
mm-hmm.
Some of the things that even we had to go through before the civil rights law came about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was alive, very much alive in our home.
Right. Wow. And your father passed in December 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Before his passing, he lived to see a black president. So
mm-hmm.
what was his reflection? And expound, you know, I mean expound, because I really want to understand how a man that is born a son of a slave, a son of slaves, that is raised as a sharecropper, that becomes a sharecropper, that knows that there's going to be an end to this and goes on this world quest to see what else life in this world, in this harsh world that he has been born into, has to offer, does this world traveling, and before the sun sets, please expound.
That was, I tell everybody that night that of the election, my dad had already talked about the election a lot, and he said that, you know, he hadn't really expected to see a black president before he passed. But once we knew it was going to happen, he knew it was going to happen before any of us knew it was going to happen. He told us that he was going to be elected. And the night of the election, I was with my dad, and we stayed up all night long watching it. And he actually cried. He really did. He said, I never would have believed it until I saw that it was going to happen. He was ecstatic. He was ecstatic. And, you know, I can't say President Obama couldn't do any wrong, but he was very, very, very proud to have a black president. My dad was very much a person who believed that blacks are great people. He taught us that. He taught that we do great things, we are great people, we have to live up to that. So
uh-huh.
he was just excited to see that.
Wow.
And so I have a picture that I sent around to all my family and friends of him sitting and watching President Obama's second inaugural, and my dad is
wow.
sitting there watching it in his bedroom, you know, hanging on every word that President Obama
wow.
said. And I just
wow.
thought that was really significant.
Wow. I would love to see that picture. If you would tag me,
I
if
will
you would
send you
post
that picture.
It and tag me,
yeah.
Yes, please do, please do.
Okay.
And that does bring us to when we talk about presidents, and we're talking about talking to a presidential diarist, I want to read what it says on the back of your book, Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road. Now, this book sat here for I don't know how long before I called you, and I was like, what? Why didn't you tell me? I mean, you were just quiet, as they would say, a church house mouse. I mean, it's like, okay, this is what I get. You know, I mean, when I'm interested in something or someone, it doesn't matter. I go for it. I don't care. And I'll learn later who you are. And I am looking at this book, and I happen to see on the back that there is a quote from President William J. Clinton. And I almost lost my mind. I turned the book back over, and I said, okay, this is Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road by Janice F. Kearney. Yes, it is. But she didn't tell me anything about this, and I have talked to her several times. I don't understand how this didn't come up. But that's just a testament to your humility, okay? Coming up as a sharecropper's daughter to the diarist of President William Jefferson Clinton, which we're going to get into in a minute, but we're not finished with TJ, who should have been president, by the way. But I was fascinated to hear how TJ and Ethel managed to feed, clothe, and shelter their kids, and even more, how they were able to find the right mix of love and discipline to allow them all to become their own persons, different in fascinating ways, yet bound together as a family. President William J. Clinton. Now, first of all, sister, let me stand up, okay, and bow down and salute a sister up in this house at Tribe Family Channel. Because, yes, it is real. The sister went from where she was struggling and making ends meet with her family sharecropping. I heard the part about swinging that hoe down on that cotton. Now, I stopped by a field of cotton because I live in the country, and I wanted to see cotton up close. And I stopped and parked by a field of cotton, got out, and I can't even tell you how my heart felt looking at the cotton and the balls and the thorns. I could not imagine, and then I did imagine, because it's so hot out here, I imagined white men on horses being right there in this hot sun and having to hurry up and dig in there amongst those thorns and grab that cotton and fill that bag. And my heart sank. So my hat is off to you, sister, from going from there, breaking barriers, and writing President William Clinton's diary. Y'all heard it. Yeah, she did it. Okay? So to that, I commend you. And
thank you.
Through your walk, yes, through your walk in life, battling the vicissitudes of life and taking that undergirding, that a strong foundation, a strong parent that persevered, there is nothing that could have stood in your way. I beg to differ. There may have been a lot of challenges in life, but from the preparations in the beginning, there was nothing that was going to prevent and stop you from becoming and stepping into the greatness that your life was called to be and do. And so we're going to step into that area where you wrote, and well, I won't say wrote because it's the President William Clinton's diary, but where you did what you do, which would say at this point, explain what a diarist is.
It's a living biographer. You're writing the biography of the president as he's being the president. You're creating a documentation of his days. Each day I wrote a diary for his presidency, whatever was going on in the Clinton presidency for that day. I documented it and made it part of his diary.
Wow. So the sister, y'all hear this now. She's flying around on Air Force One. She's riding in the presidential caravan. You're all over the world. You're in the White House. You're with presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton. You're right there with President Clinton. Chelsea's growing up with her rosy cheek. and you're documenting a family, a presidency, a legacy being left. He's a Rhodes Scholar. And I understand that his autobiography is all in his own hand. Is that correct?
I would think so, yeah. It's his words for sure, yeah.
Well, what I mean by his own hand is handwritten.
Oh, his autobiography?
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tell you.
Okay,
you
mean
his biography that he wrote himself?
Yes.
His autobiography,
not sure.
The one that he wrote, My Life.
You know, I am not sure of the name of it, and I could be going off hearsay, but I thought that in the years back that it was released that it was the only biography that was actually written in his own hand. But back to the diary. Tell us what does a day in the presidency begin? How does that day begin in the White House? Is it 4 a.m., 3 a.m.? Is it, you know, tea, coffee, poached egg? How does that day begin?
It starts out between 6:30 and 7. You get to the White House, and there was always a chief of staff meeting that lasted about an hour, which was actually when the president's day was scheduled and discussed. And the chief of staff would share what he would be doing, and everybody would go around if they had anything to chip in or add to that. Also, that was the time that you learn what the big events for today was, what the problems for the day was, what kind of media interest there was. So, and my day would go from that to actually working to schedule what I do as far as his day. If he had a meeting, if he had a special event, if he had a fundraiser, whatever he had to do, which one of those things would I be following him, would I go to, would I travel with him to, what was important for history's sake. And that was kind of how we kind of planned my day with him. Now, whether I was actually physically with him or not, I still had to create my diary, and I had a lot of different documents and information that I could use to help create that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there usually until he left for the day, and that could be late in the evening, depending on what his day was like.
Wow. And we're coming to the close of the show, and I just wanted to get a couple of questions in there with regard to you know, the current times and the election and what's happening with Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now, let me ask you, as a woman, how would you feel about seeing a woman president?
I would feel absolutely fine. And I'd ask myself and others, why did it take so long?
Wow.
I mean, there have been women that was capable of doing the job for years, for decades. So I'm hoping that finally we've decided we're going to allow a woman to take the helm, because a lot of times, and I love men, but a lot of times men are better at creating conflicts or problems, and it's the women actually who have to go in and rectify those or resolve those. And I really think that women have a much more well-rounded and broader view of the world and of life, and are able to be fixers much more so, I think, than men.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, it has been an extreme honor, privilege, and pleasure to have you on Tribe Family Channel, to have this discussion, and to reflect on the legacy and the life of Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Vonner Road. I want to remind our listeners that they can pick up a copy of this wonderful legacy at Writing Our World Press, which is writingourworldpress.com. And if our listeners want to connect with you on social media, where can they find you on Twitter and Facebook?
You would have asked me, but you can find me on Twitter. I think if you just put Janice Kearney or Janice F. Kearney, either one of those, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to Tribe Family Channel. This is Beverly Black Johnson, and you have been listening to Voices of Wisdom Season 4 with Janice F. Kearney, the diarist for President William Clinton. And if you want to follow her on Twitter, it is at Kearney, K-E-A-R-N-Y, 9949. Or excuse me, let's start all over. The at sign, K-E-A-R-N-E-Y. So you can just pull up Janice Kearney, J-A-N-I-S, F, middle initial, Kearney, and you'll come upon her at Kearney, and then you'll see some numbers following her last name. It has been an honor, privilege, and pleasure
having this conversation with you.
I cannot wait to have you on our show, because I want to, on another show, that is, The Woman at the Well. And so later when that season comes up, you know, I want to get down to, like, the struggles and the overcoming, because to whom much is given, much is required. We all have a testimony. We're all, you know, struggling and healing from something. And so The Woman at the Well, it's that conversation where we go into that struggle and we talk about, you know, the depths of, you know, life and the vicissitudes that we were met with. We've covered abuse, we've covered, you know, military abuse, we've covered different areas where people have struggled to overcome addiction and drug addiction or alcoholism and anything that life may, you know, throw at you. But the one thing we do know is that everyone is hurting and healing from something. And so this is Beverly Black Johnson, live from Tribe Family Channel, and I want to thank you, Janice F. Kearney. It's been a pleasure. I want to wish you continued travel.
Thank you so much, Beverly. I enjoyed it.
Likewise, likewise. And please do tune in to tribefamilychannel.com. We have some amazing shows coming up in September, and you can follow us at Tribe Family US or go to tribefamilychannel.com. Janice, my pleasure, and you stay
my
blessed.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.